Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the NOLA Drinks Show, friends, this week. As always, got a great one coming up for you here today. Our coverage continues from Tales of the Cocktail 2019, another great episode that we taped there, joined by two of the foremost cocktail authors and historians on the planet. That is not an exaggeration. That is the truth. Dave Wondrich and Jeff Beachbum Berry. Dave is a remarkable cocktail historian and author, as is Jeff. Dave has written a couple great books, writes for the Daily Beast. Go check out his books, Imbibe and Punch. Jeff has various publications out as well. Friend of the show. He's been on before. You know all that. Potions of the Caribbean, Sip and Safari. Go check out Jeff's work. You can also see Jeff at Latitude 29 there in the French Quarter, the place he runs with his wife, Anine, a fantastic tiki bar. These guys are two of the most knowledgeable guys around. They did a seminar at Tales tracing the development of cocktail lists. Yeah, the printed stuff, right? When you go into a bar, you go into a restaurant, and it's a really, really interesting historical conversation that they bring to the show based on their seminar. So it's a lot of tracing the past and tracing the history, as I said, but also they give some tips and thoughts and ideas for the contemporary bar owner or bartender, beverage director, things to think about if you're putting together a cocktail list today. They actually give their 10 or was it 11 commandments. I think we kind of get into that a little bit of some things to think about. But it's a very, very interesting conversation, friends, that we kind of dovetail into all kinds of things. As we always do on the show, friends, if you're listening on the radio, go get the podcast. Check out noladrinks.com. You'll find links to get the podcast on your favorite platform, or just go to your favorite podcast platform and search for NOLA Drinks. You'll find it that way too. What we always do on the show here is that we do an extended podcast-only segment called Another Shot with NOLA Drinks. Dave and Jeff stick around, and it is a doozy. It's a gem. We have a great time. We even start talking about dive bars in Milwaukee, okay? That'll just give you a little flavor of why you want to go get the podcast if you're listening here on the radio. Friends, quick note, coming up this weekend, one of my favorite events all year, Satchmo Summerfest. Kicks off on Friday right here, August 2nd, about 11 o'clock in the morning at the New Orleans Jazz Museum. Goes Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. This great event is put on by our good friends, French Quarter Festivals Incorporated. Yeah, you know we've been doing a series featuring musicians that play at French Quarter Festival, which happens in April. And also, Satchmo Summerfest. Last two shows featured musicians playing at this weekend's Satchmo Summerfest. As I said, there at the New Orleans Jazz Museum, formerly known as the Mint, right there in the corner of the French Quarter Esplanade, where it dead ends at the river. All kinds of great food and drink, wall-to-wall music on three stages, two outside, one in the upstairs venue in the museum, which is a spectacular venue. Great sound. There's going to be air conditioning, so you can go check that out as well. $6 daily admission, be aware of that, but that is a very nominal price to pay for wall-to-wall music like that. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Go check out SatchmoSummerfest.org for more information. We'll see you out there. Great music honoring the legacy and tradition of Louis Armstrong. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drinks Show, and then we're going to be bouncing over to Two Jags for our featured interview with Dave Wondrich and Jeff Beachbum Berry. Come on back. Everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. As always, this is part of our Tales of a Cocktail coverage, which by the time you're hearing this, ended some time ago. We could all be dead by now, for that matter. And I'm pleased to be joined by two great guests, Dave Wondrich. Dave, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing really well, man. Thanks awesome. For making time. It's great to see you.
My pleasure.
And my friend, Jeff Beachbum Berry. Jeff, how are you?
All right. Happy to be here.
Hey, thanks for making time.
Happy to be anywhere.
Happy to be here. Especially here. Yeah. Don't lie to me, Jeff. But great. Yeah, you guys having a good tales so far?
Yeah, so far so good. You know, okay. Busy, but... Maybe I'm doing a little less than I've done in years past, and that makes me happy.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, because some years have been just absolutely hectic, and this one is just below hectic.
Okay.
So that's
nice.
Good.
It does seem to be a little bit more, like last year was the mellowest one I've been to for different reasons, obviously, and this one's probably the second mellowest one that I've been to. How about you, Jeff?
Yeah, it's been great. It's as you said, it's just a little bit more energy than last year when they were turning the cruise ship around and resetting the whole thing. And and now I just really like the fact that there seems to be a whole new generation of people coming. It's not just the same old faces. Not that I didn't love the old faces, and I'm always happy to see them, but it's also good to see an infusion of new blood with new concerns and all that. So I think it's got a shot in the arm.
Yeah,
it's great.
Absolutely.
I've also seen less suspenders and curly mustaches.
Well, as a fan of both, I'm a little disappointed. Yeah. That never gets old.
That
as far
never
as I'm
gets
concerned. Yeah.
Right, absolutely.
It is a timeless look, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
At least once every 7 or 8 decades,
yeah,
Dave, right?
Exactly.
Well, great. Well, you guys did kind of part of the theme here of the show is based on a seminar that y'all just did on cocktail lists. And why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah.
Maybe kind of frame the topic a little bit for us, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, it was called The Cocktail Menu, History and Theory. Mm-hmm. And the first half of the seminar, we just basically went through our collection of menu porn. We're both total, like, ephemera nerds, and we each have according to our own interests, like a vast cocktail and restaurant menu collection. So the first half was just us showing off our stuff and then trying to put it into some kind of an historical timeline to give it a little bit of context.
Yeah, I mean, that was fun, though.
Yeah.
There's just an example of us showing off our stuff. Jeff puts in our presentation pictures of a die-cut menu from the Roosevelt Hotel shaped like a Sazerac. And I go to my collection and pull out its twin shaped like a Ramos fist.
Yeah.
Really? And was this coordinated or was this
totally random.
I'll see your Sazerac.
And I'll raise you a Ramos. Then, of course, Dave had to point out that his Ramos was older than my Sazerac.
Yeah. Okay. So
but yours is more fun than mine.
Fair enough.
Way to defer after the fact, after the gamesmanship there. So that's really cool.
So that was the first part. And then the second part was, we've both been in and out of the professional side of the whole thing. But mostly, I think I can speak for Dave a little bit. I mean, mostly we spent many, many decades as customers on the other side of the bar. And that's where I learned everything that I wanted in a bar is when I was sitting as a paying or sometimes non-paying guest when I got lucky. and you learn what you like and you don't like about bars, and you also learn what you like and you don't like about menus. So the second half was our sort of Ten Commandments about what we like to see in a menu and what may or may not work depending on what city you're in and what your clientele is, and just try to give a few guidelines. And, of course, the 11th commandment was just ignore 1 through 10. You know, it's
as needed.
Right.
They're merely suggestions. But, you know, they did come from also a fair amount of experience at the fun part of the bar. But I've done, for instance, cocktail lists for probably something like 10 different bars over the years, you know, as a consulting gig. And I've seen which ones worked better than the others. So there's that, too. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of that. And you obviously have cocktail lists at your bar.
Yeah. But as part of your gig, was it to write the copy for the drinks, too?
Yeah, it was everything, yeah.
Because that's the important thing, you know. As you said, Dave did one for a restaurant that was 5/9, where he had, like, brilliant copy that just sort of gave a historical little story for each drink. And it's the kind of thing that draws you in as a customer and goes, I want that because I just want to participate in this little narrative, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, not every customer can talk to the bartender. Sometimes they're at a table over there, and this is a way of giving them a little bit of a spiel with the drink. You don't want to be annoying about it. That's the thing. You don't want to go overboard. You don't want to make it a whole, like, I've got to wade through all this stuff. But if you throw in a little sentence of, you know, snappy prose about the drink, I find that helps people to figure out which drink is the one for them, you know, which one has which story is their story.
I was actually just going to ask you that, Dave, because I was going to ask, is there a point where you get too much?
Oh, yeah.
And you get a little too prosaic, or if I have to read a paragraph.
That was one of the commandments, was thou shalt not kill thy guest's attention span.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Awesome.
I mean, I think that extends to a bunch of things. Often cocktail lists have too many cocktails on them. And, you know, people, choice puts people on the spot, and that's really putting people on the spot. I know it puts me on the spot. I'm, like, trying to say, what about this one or this one? I don't know. You know, and that's when people just say, to hell with it, I'll have a martini or, I'll have a vodka soda or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to be very careful about that. It depends on the kind of bar, too, right? Because a tiki bar, you can't have too few. You need a number of drinks there.
You do, and there are some places that have up to 80, like in the style of Don the Beachcomber, who had like 70 drinks in his menu. But I just think that's just punishment for your staff at this point, and also for your guests. I mean, it's going to take you 20 minutes to choose a drink. And like what we were talking about during the actual seminar, and we've got 38 in total, but that's broken down into communal drink. I mean, very specialized thing. If you're one person alone, you're not going to look at the communal drink section. If you're not pregnant or teetotaling it, you're not going to look at the mocktails. You're just going to look. Something's going to be in your strike zone. Won't take that long. But places that have 70, 80 drinks, people come to bars for a lot of different reasons other than just to have a drink. I mean, they're renting a seat. It's a little bit of real estate, so that they could have a business meeting or they can have a date, and they need to focus on who they're with. They can't devote that much time to reading a menu.
Right.
And something that we touched on in the seminar was like 9 times out of 10 people come into Latitude and they look at this big fold out menu and the first thing they do is ask the server, what should I drink? And I was like,
yeah. Right.
That's something is, yeah, there's a certain mismatch there.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to, some people do come into bars. A lot of people do come into modern cocktail bars because they are geeky about the cocktails. But I think the best solution for that is you have a cocktail list, and then you can have the reserve book, or you know, here's our deep list compiled from all our back catalog drinks or whatever. Or the best part is you just hire bartenders who know how to make everything.
Right.
Yeah. They're the walking computer program.
And then, you know, if it's not too busy, you can ask and talk with your bartender. You can consult with the highly skilled professional who is behind the bar there.
Yeah, Lost Lake does that. I mean, that's a tiki bar in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Paul McGee's got like maybe 12 drinks. No, there's more than that. But there's maybe, I don't think there's more than 20 drinks on the menu.
No, there's not.
But he's got a secret menu which is printed out, which has 100 tiki classic drinks. The girl comes in who wants to try like something sort of deep into the jungle and off the menu, they just break out the Bible. Mm-hmm. You know,
okay,
that's exactly what you're talking about.
So that sort of gives you the best of both worlds.
Yeah. I've always found it's kind of helpful, and I think this is what you guys are saying. If you go into a place and a solid cocktail bar, gastropub type situation, flip open the cocktail book, and here's the 8 or 10 that we want to show off to you.
Yeah, that's...
And then you can find your way into... Either they know how to make it, or you can find your way into other stuff.
Yeah, that's, you know, the speed list, so to speak.
Yeah.
But what I find bars are doing now a lot more, the cocktail bars, is sort of the latest trend, is to have maybe 6 to 8 drinks, period. And then, you know, and that's their cocktail list, and these are our suggestions, and then talk to the bartender, you know. Mm-hmm. But that gives you enough so that people who aren't right there at the bar can choose something nice to drink. Mm-hmm. But also for that, you need to really train your servers, too, at table. You know, they have to know that there are other drinks than on the list.
Right.
And they have to, say, I'm sure our bartenders can make that. I'll be right back.
You know, one of the questions I love to hear your perspective on this, because I'll ask from a business side of things. When you do that sort of approach of having, you know, maybe up to 10 or something as your featured cocktail list, a speed list, as you said, Dave, the percent that of drink purchases and selections that drives. And usually I hear the number is, or, you know, people will tell me 70, 80, 90% of what they sell is on their list.
Is off the menu?
Off like the featured list.
It's on the menu on a featured
list, at, you know, if it's 8 or 10 or 12 or whatever those are. And people read, you know, the drink and make a choice that way.
One of my favorite bars is Long Island Bar in Brooklyn, New York, not far from my house, which is run by Toby Cicchini, the guy who wrote the book Cosmopolitan, and, you know, an OG bartender. And he's got 8 drinks on his list, and I go there quite often, and I'm always looking to see what people are drinking. They're usually drinking the drinks from his list. Mm-hmm. Then you get a jerk like me who comes in and says, you know, I see that you got that rum back there, and I was hoping you could mix that with, stuff over here. And the bartender, you know, these veteran bartenders, you know, will roll their eyes and joke with me a little bit, but they'll make whatever I ask, mm-hmm. perfectly, you know. But But most of the drinks there, I think, probably do come off that short list. Mm-hmm. You know, because people are fine. You know, it's a good list, and people, most people go to bars, even the good cocktail bars, not for the exact cocktails they're serving. They go there to have a cocktail and be with their friends,
right,
and socialize and relax and have a place where they can put their phone face down on the bar and not have to, where they can switch off for a while.
Yeah,
and
right.
Drinks are whatever, you know.
Yeah.
A good drink is great and people really appreciate it, but one drink is often as good as another one. You know?
Right. Right.
As long as there's something.
Yeah. And just to speak to what you were saying about that list, coming from the 1980s, when there were no cocktail menus in any of the bars I went to in Los Angeles, I don't know what it was like in New York, but you walk into a bar and it was like you're expected to know what you're going to drink. And I had just become of legal drinking age in 1980. I didn't know anything about cocktails. All I knew was, okay, a screwdriver has vodka and orange juice. I'll just, right. If somebody said, what do you want? Yeah. I'll just say that. And I don't even like screwdrivers.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, but I would order, because like, I just got to have something in front of me.
You got to be able to say something.
Yeah. So if there's a list, even with four or six drinks, yeah. I was always really, oh, okay.
Yeah, I'll have one of these.
What is that? I'll have that. You know, yeah. Like a, you know, there's no vodka or orange juice in it. I'll have it. Yeah, exactly.
You know, Jeff, it's funny to say this, because I went to college, as you know, I went to college in San Diego. We've had this conversation 100 times. And you know, spent a lot of time in Tijuana.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, late 80s and early 90s. I can't tell you how many kamikazes I had for the reason that you said. In Tijuana, there's Cuervo, and it's like, well, kamikaze is the only drink I know, or a shot.
That is not a bad drink.
I mean, I've had bad versions, but yeah.
Well, yeah, if you get roses in it, but if somebody actually deigns to put actual lime juice in a kamikaze, it's not bad.
It's not terrible. I drank plenty of those. I went to high school on Long Island in New York, and there were all the bars were like serving that, and of course the infamous Long Island iced tea, newly introduced, which I went and drank at the place that invented it.
Cool.
You know, with my fake ID, and which I needed because I was only 17 and the drinking age was 18. So, but you know, it's funny though. For that reason, you said, like, with the screwdriver, that's when I started drinking gin martinis, because I was poor, I was a musician, and I could only afford to drink in old man bars in New York. And if you went into an old man bar and asked for a kamikaze, the grumpy old cuss behind the bar was not very happy.
Like, I fought them during the war.
Yeah.
Yeah. I shot them down. Yeah. I'm not going to give you one.
And they just roll their eyes, you know, another stupid kid. But Yeah. Now, these guys probably were on the other side.
Yeah, right.
I was in the 15th Panzer Division. There were a lot of somewhat suspect Eastern Europeans who.
Okay.
You know,
A lot of slobs pouring your beer, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of Polish guys who couldn't speak Polish.
Gotcha.
You know, Silesians. So, you know, but if you ask for a dry martini, they go, all right, this kid at least knows how to drink, you know. And you learn very quickly there's more alcohol in a dry martini than there is in any other drink.
It's a glass full of gin.
Yeah. There you go.
Yep, and gin is strong.
Let's do this, you guys. Let's take a little break. Is that cool? Friends, we're chatting here with Dave Wondrich and Jeff Beachbum Berry on the No Old Drink Show. Taking a little break. Come on back. Back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the NOLA Drink Show, friends, here on WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We're talking about the history of we're talking a lot about just drinking back in the 80s. And but we're chatting here with Dave Wondrich and Jeff Beachbum Berry, and they did a seminar on the history and development of cocktail lists. And actually, you know, how about we talk about this, guys, a little bit? Kind of, you mentioned like a die-cast cutout from the Roosevelt, from the Sazerac Bar, going back a ways. What kind of development have we seen? We were talking about you go into a bar in the 80s, Jeff, in L.A., and there was no such thing as a cocktail list. But maybe when we go back a little bit further, how were drinks being presented, and kind of what how do we describe the trajectory?
A little further towards like post-prohibition,
maybe, or wherever you want to start. Yeah,
we could start in the early 19th century.
Yeah.
You first start seeing cocktail lists in the 1840s, and there was a guy in Boston who pioneered the whole thing. This crazy Yankee, Peter Bent Brigham, and he had a list of like 30 drinks, and it was sort of scandalous. It's like, you know, this is doing a horrible thing to our youth, corrupting them with all these tempting sounding potions. But everybody copied the list. I don't know where they got the recipes because he never gave them out. So I think it was pretty bartenderly, as in I'm just going to make it up and call it that. but the list jumped the Atlantic. They were serving that list in London and in Paris. And this is all by 1850. So that was really the beginning of the great age of the cocktail list, and it was a new thing with crazy sounding drinks. And you see from the mid 19th century, you see a bunch of these menus, and then maybe it gets a little more simplified after that.
Yeah, well, one of the things that was Wayne Curtis, he wrote an article about menus and imbibe, and he said that there was a devolution from this first flourishing, this first flowering of an actual cocktail list. By the late 19th, early 20th century, when the temperance movement had sort of like really mobilized and reached its peak, and they'd kind of ghettoized the cocktail experience and going to cocktail bars, and the rich people who would go to ritzy hotel bars retreated to private clubs, and the other bars just started to get a little seedier. They were getting a little less reputable,
Okay. And
the list disappeared. And by 1915, as Wayne wrote, if you walked into a bar and you didn't have you didn't name your own drink, they would look at you a little suspect, like, what's wrong with you? You know, he's like, so that there are these ups and downs. Like, there's that first flourish, Dave's period of expertise, one of his many period of expertise. Can't ghettoize Dave on that one. And then it sort of dips a little bit before Prohibition. And then after Prohibition, it bounces back. And during Prohibition, in countries where you could still drink, there was some pretty cool stuff that Dave's collected.
Yeah. Everybody had cocktail menus. And you'd, I have yet to see some of the most legendary ones, like the one at the Savoy. I've never seen an original one, but I've got ones from Harry's Bar in Paris, for instance.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
During the 20s, that are these really nice lists. That's where you start to see the lists being illustrated and have cartoons on them, and when drinking starts again, and legal drinking, drinking never stopped, especially in a town like New Orleans, which had, I believe, 5,000 speakeasies for 400,000 people, which is a reasonable number.
It's about right.
Yeah, it's about right.
That ratio is pretty close today.
They didn't really stop anything. But once legal drinking resumed and you could, do it in broad daylight, you see people going and looking at these menus from abroad and coming up with these much, much more illustrated work of art type drink menus. And that's very interesting to me.
Yeah. Again, the one area of expertise, if I may allow myself a little tooting of my own conch shell, the whole tiki thing, is that really was, and other people aside from me have said this, that the whole faux Polynesian restaurant movement really did help to innovate cocktail menus after Prohibition. They start off with like these long lists of 70 drinks with exotic names, but then that's really confusing for customers. So then they started doing illustrations.
Okay.
And first they were a little black and white drawings, so at least you knew what the drink was going to look like. Then they were like full color. Every recipe, every drink had its own like full color illustration of the glass and the garnish and everything. That's worth 1,000 words. Your server doesn't have to explain to you what all this is. Then the next thing was, okay, underneath all of these full color illustrations would be like descriptions of what the drink tasted like, so that you were even further removed from having to guess.
So Jeff, not so much ingredients, but flavor description or profile.
As we saw yesterday, some of these descriptions were absolutely useless. I mean, why are you even bothering? It's like 1,000 words is worth one picture in this case.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the example I gave was a drink from the Islander restaurant in Beverly Hills. One of the highest-end expensive nights out on the restaurant row in L.A. back in the 1960s, their description for one drink, I forget the name, was something like the ambrosia of the the Tahitian pearl mixed with the this, and it's like, okay, I'm no wiser now. You know, I just also read the description, but I'm no wiser now than before I did. You know, it's like,
do pearls have ambrosia? Yeah, well, where can I get that?
Yeah, where can I get that? Can you eat them?
They're a bit crunchy. Watch your teeth. You know, watch your dentures on them.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think the thing because tiki drinks needed to do this because other bars were making, you know, standard cocktails or variations on them. You didn't need a picture of a variation on the martini. You know, it's a martini with a rinse of absinthe or whatever.
You know, what it was.
You know, it's like it's in a small glass. You know what it's going to look like. And the tiki drinks, everyone looks different. And you can't categorize them, so you need like a lot of graphic help. So I think that was a real intuitive leap that the tiki bars had, and I think it was driven by necessity.
Right, and then other theme restaurants with different themes or other restaurants, period, continental, you know, mm-hmm. they started adopting that practice. And you saw Mexican places, Caribbean theme places, nautical places, Old West places. They all did the same thing with their specialty drinks, having a photograph, well, not a photograph, but an illustration description. Now, by the 1950s, early 60s, when color photography became more ubiquitous and cheaper, you had an even more elaborate thing, which was like they would do these dioramas. You'd have a menu that was about 1 foot by 3 feet. It was like this giant thing like in front of you. You couldn't see who was across from you. And then there would be like this one photograph with like 12 drinks on it, and the drinks were set in the sand with a little diorama behind them, and then there would be the descriptions. And that was like a full-color, fully-dressed photograph of every drink. So you knew exactly – it was almost like, you know, to get away from Caveat Emptor, you know, it's just like, here's exactly what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And don't ask me about it. This is what it looks like.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Just point.
Well, I by that point, bar personnel was heavily under stress, too. There's a lot of writing about that as, you know, they're having trouble getting good bartenders. And so, you know, this is sort of a way of selling drinks without the bartender to sell the drink for you.
Well, that's interesting. I did not know that. That's a very, that makes a lot of sense, especially with some of these Polynesian places, which had like 300-400 seats, really high volume liquor sales. So that of course they'd have trouble.
It's for the bartender too, because it better look like that. You know, here's your spec.
Right.
Here's a photo. It's on the menu. You know, make the drink.
Don't
so it
improvise.
Looks like that.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Well, hey guys, let's do this. Let's since we're kind of at a pause here, let's take a brief break, and then we'll be back and chat a little bit more about cocktail menus.
All right. Sound good?
Chatting with Dave Wunderich and Jeff Beach, Bunbury friends. We're going to take a break here on the Dolly Drink Show. Come on back.
I love you. I love you, yes, indeed. Whoa, 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 baby.
Back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you on the NOLA Drink Show. Thanks for tuning in this week, friends. As always, I want to give a special shout out to our friends here at Two Jags, the second oldest restaurant here in New Orleans, Decatur Street, 800 block. Beyond that, I can't tell you, but you can find it. It's a short block, and we appreciate them. We're chatting about cocktail menus with Dave Wunderich and Jeff Beach Bumberry. Now, let me ask you this, guys. We were sort of talking about the Ten Commandments or the plus the 11th commandment that you gave. What were some other sort of tips and things that you were telling people to do or think about? Or,
well, it's funny because one of the commandments, I mean, I wanted to try and get it down to 10, and we had to make the 11th one the 11th because there were so many of them. but one of them that I threw in, which because I thought it was kind of interesting, I read this old article from the 90s in the New York Times about all these food science people saying that you shouldn't put dollar signs on your drink prices, because that triggers something that they called and they have psychologists, food psychologists, all they do, the pain of paying. Like if you take the dollar sign off, then that sort of like frees people to go ahead and order, and they're not thinking about the money.
So just leaving the digits but not
right.
without the dollar
sign?
Right,
and they documented this. They did surveys. They did tests and all this. And then as I was saying this, Dave said, well, wait a minute, you know, there's another psychological thing that could happen with this, if you want to talk about that. It's like, it could backfire too. I mean, because people are going to get sticker shock when the bill comes, and
They're not thinking. You know, it's sort of a little bit of manipulating people,
right?
You know, and I'm not sure if that's the best way to characterize your relationship, to in your mind characterize your relationship with your customers.
It turns into huckster and then
it can.
Yeah. Mm. So in the middle of talking about this and we were kicking back and forth, it's like, well, all right, let's scratch that one. So 11 became 10 again, and all was well. and if we do this again, we're just going to have a nice, safe 10. You know, it's like, But other than that, I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple other things that we were talking about. I brought up this idea of having a little bit of writing on your menu. Some, you know, using history, if you can use history. That sells drinks. You know, there's a story behind this drink. There's a story behind that drink. If you can tie that in with your bar, that's great. I mean, one example, I did a drinks list for a bar on the west side of Manhattan, in lower Manhattan, and a couple hundred yards from there was the dock where the White Star Line docked. So I made them a house cocktail called the White Star Imperial Daisy. And a daisy is a type of drink. And an imperial means you top it off with champagne, and we used White Star champagne because that was created. Moet White Star was created for the White Star Line.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So I thought that's like kind of poetic. And then, you know, I also like to get some little bits of humor in the writing. And I did mention the fact that the Titanic was one of the was one of the White Star Line ships. So you might want to be a little bit careful.
Yeah, so I think your menu said drinker beware, by the way. It's like nota bene. Yeah. It's like then there was, you know, there were other ones. One that Dave had, which I thought was really good, and which I wish I had thought of, was the one about the signature drink, which is
I think a lot of modern bars are in a way, they're leaving money on the table because they don't have a signature drink. You know, the one drink that's always here at this bar. Because some of your customers come to your bar once a year. And people, if there's a famous drink, that makes it easy for them, you know. Mm-hmm. They come, they have the famous drink, they're not sick of the other stuff on the list. They remember that you have this drink. And if you're a good, clever mixologist, you can make that drink pretty cheap to make. And you can make a lot of money on it. Pat O'Brien certainly did.
Yeah, there's a really good example.
Yeah, right. The Sazerac House did. Henry Ramos did. Henry Ramos' signature drink, he had an egg farm up north from here. It was one of the largest egg farms in the country because his fizz has egg whites in it. And he went through thousands of egg whites a week.
And paying himself in the process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he was a very good businessman. He brought his supply chain under his control.
That's pretty cool. And,
but then he had to figure out what to do with the yolks.
Yeah.
And so he sold them to be dried and powdered for use in baking. His house, the free lunch that he served featured egg yolk omelets.
Nice.
And also he had his other signature drink that nobody ever talks about. Was the Sherry Flip, which uses an egg yolk.
Okay.
We could learn much from this man.
I know. He was a smart businessman.
And we think this whole topic of zero waste is a new thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, there's the other
waste is money.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly.
The speaking of that, I mean, we put it. I came up with a drink that I based on an old Trader Vic drink. It was mixed vanilla with passion fruit and a little lemon and pineapple and I can't say this without sounding sexist, but my friend Liz Pierce in Chicago at the Drifter restaurant, she tried and said, "This is a panty dropper." So I'm quoting her. But I didn't know what to call it, so I just said well, I'll just call it the Latitude 29. And that became our signature drink. Because people will look at the menu, they don't know what to order. This one's called Latitude 29. This must be it wasn't, but it became the de facto signature drink just because of the name. And it was like, and it works for me. It's fine. You know,
That's like sort of common sense, but yeah. I know a lot of cocktail bars are so busy trying to like stump the competition and outdo each other with the cleverness of their drinks. They're forgetting the people who are coming into the bar, and the people who are coming into the bar are people who are coming to the bar because it got written up and it's famous. You know, because other kinds of bars don't get written up anymore, except for maybe like some craft beer joints.
Right.
But that they've got all the oxygen in the press, and so you're getting a wide range of people who are coming in, and if you've got a good signature drink, you're going to make a lot of them very happy.
Yeah, you know, I'm reminded of a term, Dave, and you'll know the person, a former beverage director that I know you know in town, and he coined the term a cocktail hero.
Yeah.
And that's cocktail heroism right there, that there's really sort of a widespread in yeah. certain instances.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. Yeah, it's you know, it's something that you should be aware of.
Brian, I don't know who that is, so you can tell me afterwards if
yeah,
you want to.
But, yeah, no, you probably didn't. Darren Elisto used to run the bar program at Sylvain.
I do know Darren. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Very smart dude.
And I got to give him credit for that.
Very smart dude.
Too. Yeah, he's a super smart guy.
And
yeah.
everything's served in these little rocks glasses. You don't have to worry about what goes in what.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, that reminds me, you know, one of the things we were talking about, and I was talking about, I don't like to see the prices all over the menu, different prices for different drinks, because it just seems, you know, it's confusing to me. But Jeff, you know, made a very good point, which is going to change my thinking on this, is for some people, they say, well, you know, if these are all the same price, some of these you're getting like $3 worth of ingredients and some you're getting $5. And what, you know, are they taking this out of my pocket? I mean, I try to, when I do this, I try to arrange it so everybody's getting good value, but not everybody does that.
Well, that goes back to, I mean, for me, everything goes back to Tiki somehow. And Trader Vic was quoted at one point. He had a ham and eggs Hawaiian on his food menu at his restaurant in San Francisco. Yeah. And they said, well, what's with that? And it doesn't sound very Polynesian. It was just ham and eggs, basically, with bedspring potatoes, hash browns. You know? And he said, well, there are some, you know, again, this is like back in the sexist 50s, but he said, like, there are young men on the make who don't have any money who want to come into the Trader Vic's and still sit at the table and order something. So I'm putting something cheap on the menu for them.
Yeah.
And they can afford to eat it, and I'm going to say it's Hawaiian so that they don't feel totally out of place. And that was something that stuck in my mind. It's like, yeah, if you go to a bar and every single drink is $16 down the line, and then you look at the ingredients in the drink, you know that, well, you know, if you're not in the business, you're still going to think that drink is not as expensive to make as that
right.
drink.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
yeah.
it's like, what do you, you know, what this blanket thing.
I've done it in the past where it's two tiers, you know.
Okay.
And then the house drink is always a couple dollars more.
As it should be.
And you put something in there that sounds sexy and you make sure that you can make it for pretty cheap.
Exactly.
Let's do this, you guys. I got to close out the portion of the radio show here in about a minute and a half. So, Dave, can you tell people where they can find your publications, find you online, all that good stuff?
You can. I write for the Daily Beast. I write a cocktail column. It's a couple times a month, at least. Sometimes more. Sometimes maybe a little bit less. I'm on Twitter at David Wandrich. That's about it, really.
Okay.
I mean, you can buy my books too. Imbibe, Punch.
Yep.
Those are the ones in print. So,
and those are both very, very good ones, by the way, friends. So if you're not familiar, check them out. Jeff, what about you?
Beachbumberry.com for any information about the books or the barware I'm doing with Cocktail Kingdom. Dave also has a lot.
Oh, yeah, I have that too.
Yeah. Don't forget about that, Dave.
I forgot about that.
Merch,
there's
Dave,
nothing.
Merch.
There's nothing us freelance writers like more than a royalty check. And you know, that does happen with Cocktail Kingdom twice a year. It's a beautiful thing.
Yep.
So Beach Bum Berry for all the – and there's a little tiki history on there about the Mai Tai, the zombie, blah, blah, blah. For the restaurant, latitude29nola.com, come see us and drink our signature drink.
Awesome. Perfect. Perfect. And any number of other things, right? So, yeah, and great food there, by the way. We always want to make sure we plug the food.
Yes, we are actually a restaurant, as my wife keeps telling me to say. Yeah.
This is why I said that, because Anine would be pissed off at me for not bringing this up.
You don't want Anine, and believe me, you do not want Anine pissed off at you. I've been there, and it's not good. So.
Friends, we're going to sign off the radio portion of the show. Dave and Jeff are going to stick around for another Shot with Noel drink. So if you're listening on the radio, go get the podcast. It's far more enriching. Maybe. So remember, be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until next time.
The girl that I love is gone away. People are talking, they begin. Child, what are you doing in a place like
All right, everybody, thanks for sticking around for another shot with NOLA Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you as always. Hope you are enjoying the ongoing conversation here with Dave Wondrich and Jeff Beachbum Berry. Great conversation. We're going to bounce back over to Two Jags in just a second and continue on with that. Also wanted to note, in the first portion of the show, you may have noticed that we are playing music by the late, great Art Neville. Art passed away as we were putting together last week's show, so unfortunately we didn't have time to work the music in a week ago, but we did it now, and we wanted to just acknowledge, again, the late, great Art Neville. Losing too many music legends and others here in New Orleans these days. Friends, go see folks when you can. Going to bounce back over to Two Jags and continue our conversation with Jeff and Dave. Here we go. All right, everybody, up another shot with NOLA Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in this week. Having a good time chatting with Jeff Beachbum Berry and David Wondrich, and we were starting to explore the world of the Force and how it relates to drinking culture. I'm not sure we really came up with much of anything, but
much we did not come up with.
There is much that we did not, and as you said, more drinking we must do.
Yes. Hope there was a lot of.
Nice. Well, let me ask you this question, Dave, and I think we're in this portion of the podcast only, so it's a lot of industry folks, and thanks you industry folks for listening in. But for those of you who are maybe not, you know, familiar, I'm sure people are familiar with your work and stuff, how did you get into doing what you do?
It was entirely by accident.
Okay.
You know, I was a college professor. I was an English professor. I had just gotten the job, and I thought this is really a shitty job. I was not enjoying my job. I was a tenure-track English professor in New York City, which is a good thing, but I was not at a great college, and I was not enjoying myself. And just to sort of blow off steam, I started writing about music on the side. And I got into two very good publications right away, which was interesting to me. I got a regular gig at the Village Voice, which was a big deal at the time.
Absolutely.
Now it's gone, but
back then that was sort of the Na Plus Ultra.
And then I got a gig writing features for the Sunday Times history for the Sunday New York Times, and I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And I started writing a book about music, and a friend of mine one day in December 1999 calls me up, and he was one of those guys who worked in new media, whatever that was. You know, this was like, it was all very new. I mean, this was when everybody was using the Alta Vista search engine, which I'm sure you guys all remember well.
Yeah.
You know, when
I remember not being able to use it.
Yeah. Exactly. Through Netscape.
Yeah, exactly. It was through Netscape, and it would help you find the 128 websites that were out there. And so I'm like, okay, well, what's up, Josh? And my friend Josh Mack is he says, well, you know, I'm the new media director for Hearst Publications. And I go, oh, yeah, I remembered that. I don't know what that means. And he goes, well, Esquire magazine has a cocktail book. There's one of their old cocktail books somebody did a reprint of without asking them, and they're kind of upset, and they thought they would put it online just to claim their content, you know. And they need somebody to edit this project. And I thought of you because I know you like to write, and I know you like, you know, cocktails. Actually, by then I was mostly drinking beer, but I drank cocktails still some, and I had a few cocktail books. I had like 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 or something like that, a small collection. And I go, well, sure, I'll take a look at this. And he sent me the book. They'd already transcribed it, and I start going through the list of drinks, and I go, nobody's going to drink that one. X. And then I said, well, these are not really properly arranged. Let's arrange them in families. My training was in comparative literature, where you spend a lot of time like making sense of things that you don't know all that much about.
Right.
You know, your job is to see the deeper patterns. So I applied my training, and it was like, well, these are all the families. And I noticed that some of the most important drinks had these little paragraphs of prose with them, and others didn't. And so for those, I wrote some paragraphs in the sporty Esquire style. And I turned this thing in.
Which you did nail, because I had that book from 1948, and you kind of got it.
No, well, okay, I mean, cool. I stole it shamelessly.
Yeah, you know? As one does.
As one does. And so, I mean, just, I know I'm going on too long, but I get, you know, Esquire calls back, and they say, yeah, we like this. Those essays, can you write one of those a week, and we'll do a Drink of the Week column? And I'm like, this is like the end of December 1999, and I'm like, or maybe it's early in 2000. And I go, okay.
That was for the print edition?
No, this was for the website.
Online. Okay.
Because they needed content.
Right, right.
And I start writing a Drink of the Week column for the website, working with an editor, and they're paying me for this. As a junior English professor, paying anything is good. You know?
Yeah, wow.
I mean,
yeah.
They paid me for the gig in the first place of arranging the thing and what seemed like a handsome sum at the time that now I would laugh at. But, you know, for the amount of work involved. But so I'm writing these things, and I'm like finding history of drinks, and I'm collecting cocktail books because I always look at history of stuff. And, you know, this website starts to get some traction, and they start me writing for the magazine and at the end of 2000. And within a year or two, suddenly I'm their drinks correspondent on the masthead as a contributing editor. And I did that for, you know, a total of 17 years. It's a good long time.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
and it was the best job I ever had or ever will have. You know, working for Esquire.
And may I say, Dave is probably too genteel to say this, but as soon as he left, I canceled my subscription. And I'm not the only one. Mm-hmm. Quite a few people did the exact same. It's like, you know, that's a great loss to the cocktail community and to the magazine community as well, because there weren't too many mass market magazine venues where you could write intelligently and wittily about cocktails. And that was one of them, and when we lost it, we lost a huge...
Well, thank you for that. I mean, for me, you know, that was my dream job, and I had great editors. I had a fact-checking department, you know, to keep me honest, and, you know, all these luxuries, these, you know, that I, that are just gone.
They don't exist in publishing
anymore.
You know,
and that was... they backed me up 100% on anything I did for 10 years, the best bars thing, and mostly best bars compilations, you know, are all bars with publicists send in your PR lists, and we'll send somebody around. And for me, I went out into the country, and because I travel a lot.
You were physically in those spaces.
Yeah.
And you wrote intelligently about them.
And I wrote about a mixture of dives and bars with PR and old classic bars. The first one, the Napoleon House was our first bar.
And now, not to turn this into a bitch session, but what you get now is people writing for online venues, which shall remain nameless, and that pay nothing. Mm-hmm. And if you're being paid, okay, here's $30 to write about the 10 best bars in the Southeast, and they'll go online. What's in it for them? I'm only getting 60, 30. I'm getting no money at all. I'm going to spend 5 minutes online. That's all this is worth. And I'm going to see what hits I get. And then those are the best bars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like what Dave was doing back in the day with Esquire was what was called shoe leather among old reporters.
Yeah.
You know,
I went to every bar. Sometimes I didn't go more than once, but I went and spent time.
It's shoe leather. And that's the derivation of the word gumshoe from Private Eyes. Yeah. It was like you were hitting the pavement and you were in the venues, you know. And that's, I don't know. I don't want to get negative or anything about that.
I'm 100% in agreement. Yeah. And I mean, and Jeff, you and I have had this conversation before. One of my least favorite new words in the lexicon here is listicle.
Oh, God.
Yeah, well, that's what you get now. When you're not paying anything anybody, they figure this is only worth a half an hour of my time because I can make more money bagging groceries for what you're paying me.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go online for half an hour, sit in this chair, find some bar names, throw them out there, repeat whatever said, and I'm done, and I'm moving on to my next underpaying job.
Right.
Our best bars thing, it was my editor, Ross McCammon, and I, and Ross was a very smart guy, and he and I would spend months on this, like, you know, conversation. Then as we got closer, we spent more time on it, but we chose the bars carefully. And then the best part of the job is I reached the point where I realized there were holes in the map because Esquire didn't have a travel budget. They didn't have a lot of money, so they couldn't send me to places. I travel a lot in the course of business, so I'd always be wherever I'm in the city. I'd always make time to go to hit some bars and write notes, some of them which proved to be illegible.
Those were the good
bars.
Yeah. I've got some notes from Croke Park, known as Whitey's in Boston, that are just absolute gobbledygook.
Best bar ever.
That was Whitey Bulger's bar. Right.
Oh, really?
Oh, man.
He owned a bar? I didn't know that.
That was where he drank.
Where he drank. Okay.
And that was a nasty bar. But we got to this point where we see these holes in the map, and I said, well, you can send me to one city. So I'd do a 24-hour bar crawl where I'd go land in the city and go to, like, 10 or 12 or 16 bars over the course of 24 hours, which was rough.
Yeah.
But I think
it would.
You know, because I'd have to have at least one drink in each bar, and I'd be like, oh, my God. But I went to, like, Milwaukee and for that, and St. Louis for that, and Detroit. D.C. I think I walked 9 miles in D.C. because you could do it. And I was like, my rule is walk 1 mile and that burns off one drink.
Yeah.
Which is actually not true, but it's worth a try.
It gets you through the night.
Exactly.
You know, you got to say, it's like, just got to make it 1 more mile to the next bar, then I'm good again.
But that, if I may interject, that was one of the great things about the Esquire Bar Guide is that it was full of bars in the flyover states. It wasn't just about, the coastal elite
bars.
No,
that's what we worked on. That's what we wanted. When I went to Milwaukee for the first time, holy shit, I found a culture I did not know, and the bars there were insane. I arrive on a Tuesday afternoon around lunchtime, and I'm walking around, and I had a list of the oldest bars in Milwaukee, which I always try to start with, and the first two were closed and gone. Closed, you know, they still had websites up, but they were already gutted, and I'm like, this is not good, and now it's 2 o'clock, and I'm hungry, and I'm like, where do I go? Oh, there's a brew pub. What the hell? You know, it's not on my list, but I'll go. And I walk in, and it's 2 o'clock on a Tuesday, and the place is absolutely packed. There's one seat open at the bar. And I go, and I shoehorn myself in. The guy next to me is drinking vodka cranberries in pint glasses with his car keys on the bar in front of him. The three guys on the other side of me are rolling dice with the very attractive female bartender, trying to convince her that she'd make more money working the pole as a stripper.
Oh, great.
and they're gambling for free drinks and playing bar dice, something I had not encountered previously.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, Liar's dice, right? Is that what we're talking about?
No, it's a whole Milwaukee bar dice is a whole world to it.
Okay.
And it's this complicated dice game and with its own language. And I'm like,
oh, wow.
When we wrote up, I wrote this up and I included a guide to Milwaukee bar dice in the best bars thing. We always got to do stuff like that,
And you're not going to know that exists unless you fucking go there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I found it at all the bars in town.
Yeah.
Well, there was the bar on that trip, a German beer bar, and I go to visit the bathroom, and the urinals all had little soccer goals in them with balls dangling in them. Like the only sport was being played on TV was European League soccer, football. Mm-hmm. You know, in Milwaukee, they're like, this is a strange place.
This is an alien planet, man.
Yeah, and I'm just going by myself, you know, and I'm going here, and then I go to Bryant's Lounge, the darkest cocktail lounge in the world.
With 100 ice cream drinks or something?
Yeah, absolutely lovely, with a 1970s... Macintosh stereo, tube stereo, tube amp, and they're playing, who's the English mod, like jazz R&B organ player?
Jackson?
No, this is from the 60s. Yeah,
okay.
And it's just this beautiful, like, organ jazz, this guy singing, and it just sounds like the sound is coming from inside your head.
Wow.
And it's pitch black in there, and I finally, I can't see anything until by the time I leave, my eyes are completely adjusted, and I'm like, this is a really bad sign.
I've been here too long. Yeah. I stayed too long at the fair.
But, I mean, Jeff, you travel all over, too. I mean, you go to some of these places.
Yeah. I mean, I make a point of going to some of the crappiest places I can, because that's where the life is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the life is not really in the 50 best bars.
No.
I mean, I vote for that thing, but some of the things I submit as my vote, I know they're not going to go anywhere. It's like a protest vote.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like I go to bars in like Lisbon or Buenos Aires or Cincinnati or Cleveland that make me happy because their experience is their third space. It's not work. It's not home. It's just this thing you can do that entertains you. I mean, I spent half of my life in movie theaters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when that got old, I resolved to spend the second half of my life in bars. And I'm finding that you can find entertainment in ways that you never could have dreamed until you actually set your shoes down through the door and get into the room.
Mm-hmm.
And time, for me, a good bar is where time stops.
Yeah.
Oh. You walk in and time stops. You are finally in the present. Because for me, the present doesn't really exist. I've tried my whole life to hold on to the present. There's just the past becoming the future, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Not to get too metaphysical about this.
Yeah.
But when you get into a bar where everything's, all the cylinders are firing or not firing, mm-hmm. as the case may be, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. where it's just like time is, it's just that Eugene O'Neill thing, oh, we're afraid of the automobiles, you know? Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite bars in the world is Bar Boadas in Barcelona. They don't even have running water behind the bar.
No, they do not.
It was founded in 1933. It's been running since. The owner, Miguel Boadas, when he died, his daughter took over. And she just died 2 years ago in her 80s, you know, Doña Maria. And she made the drinks and did the long, they throw cocktails there. They do this long pour, acrobatic pour high in the air, you know. And she did that forever. And the regulars there are all, you know, kind of older, not like decrepit, but, you know, it's like people with lives and interesting stories, et cetera. And you just see the liveliness of that bar, and it's just, you so want to be a part of that community.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. you want to fit mm-hmm. into that bar.
And there's another thing, Dave, not to interrupt.
Please.
Is not just the liveliness of some bars, but the deadness of some other bars,
yeah.
which is equally attractive.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just like, I'm not in a goth way or anything, but just, time has stopped.
Yeah. Yep.
Nobody's evolving in this bar. Nobody is moving forward. Nobody is like kicking it into the next gear so that they can compete in the modern economy. They are just there, you know, and that is also attractive. That's as attractive as people who have lives and who are like meeting to congregate and exchange information, you mm-hmm. know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's places that aren't manufactured, you know.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it.
I think, and many of our modern, some of our modern bars that right now I find a little bit sterile, I always like realize, you know, if they can stay open in like 20 or 30 years, this is going to be a pretty great place to drink. Mm-hmm. You know, all it takes is a little deferred maintenance and some duct tape, and suddenly you're a dive bar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking to that, I don't know if we've had this conversation, but we may have because it's been a long few days at Tails. But I was in Italy not long ago, and this guy, Alex Fraza, who has a podcast much like yours, mm-hmm. He sat me down and he wanted to talk about stuff. And I just happened to casually mention dive bars in, mm-hmm. I forget what the context was or what anything was. And he goes, what's that? What's a dive bar? And we were in Naples, Italy. And I was like, they don't know what that is. And I said, suddenly I had to describe what a dive bar was to people who have no concept of it. It's like mm-hmm. being in Alpha Centauri and trying to explain.
It works differently in Italy.
Yeah. And so I tried my best, and I derailed the entire podcast, which is about tiki, but it ended up being about trying to define a dive bar.
Yeah.
And they were mystified by it. I said, okay, let me see if I can get this straight. If you call it a dive bar, the owner of a proper dive bar would be really upset. This is not a dive bar. This is a bar. Mm-hmm. And then they looked at this very abstract for them. It's like, what do you mean? Okay. What a dive bar is basically is a neighborhood bar, beer and a shot, not really cocktail, mm-hmm. that's been around long enough to acquire some patina or some atmosphere or whatever so that you go there and you feel like you're part of. And they, we don't understand.
Yeah.
It's like, all right. So if the owner of the bar calls itself a dive bar, it's not a dive bar.
Yeah.
And again, I just dug myself deeper. It's just like, you can't really explain.
No, you can't explain. I mean, Italians do things entirely differently. They've got a lot of old bars that are kind of divey, but they also serve coffee in the morning.
Yes.
They serve pastries.
Yes.
They might serve candy. They might like be a candy store.
12 hours, they're serving everybody, and it's just like the place where you go to get your needs met.
Yeah, whatever they are. Because they don't, for them, drinking isn't like you go out at night to drink. That's an Anglo-Saxon concept. For them, you know, you have a drink at the right time during the day, and there's not that opprobrium. You know, there's not that, like, oh, once you enter a bar, you're on hot rails to hell. It's like you go into a bar, you come out of the bar, right? You know? Right. It's like, it's normal.
And it's still light outside. Yeah,
it's still light outside. It's normal. But you know, in America, it's very, very different. And, you know, you think of some of these, I think of this bar, one of the diviest bars in probably this wing of the galaxy is a Max Club Deuce in Miami.
Oh yeah,
and Max Club Deuce is on it's in Miami Beach, and it is horrifically divey, right? Although it just does have a nice neon sign. So I went, and this is my way. I did a little research on it. When it opened, it was a fancy cocktail bar in 1934, okay, you know, and in the 30s, it was like a supper club, and it was the place where people pulled up in their Rolls Royces and went in, and then it just kept going, and Miami Beach deteriorated, and they still hung on. They started fixing things with duct tape, and, you know, and when somebody kicked in the mirror in the bathroom, they left the shards there, and they didn't scrape out the graffiti on the inside of the toilet, and that takes a lot of determination.
Right, a lot of determination.
But you know, if you're tagging the toilet bowl, I think you might have made some wrong choices in life.
Yeah. But then again, it shows a certain determination that we must applaud as the American way.
Yeah, right, it's true. And the first time I was at Max, there was a bartender there, right? And he had a whole system. It's like, you buy your drink, I give you a coin. If you want another one, you buy another coin. You put the coin on the bar. And if the coin is this part of the bar, I'm not going to serve you. If you move it to the edge of the bar, I will serve you, but you have to give me your old drink first. And he's going on and on. And we're like, oh, my God, these rules. But we're trying to follow. And if it's wrong, he lets you have it.
Yeah.
And so we go back the next day because we thought that was, in spite of his weirdness, we were really digging on the bar.
Yeah.
And we start lining up our coins. And this guy goes, no, man, that was just Ricky.
That's not a thing.
That's just how he does.
Ricky's not here now, man.
Ricky's not here now. No, you know, give me your money and I'll give you a drink.
That's hilarious. There's a particular bar, I may have mentioned this to you before, my favorite bar still to this day, kind of the bar I grew up in. It's called the Mission Bell Tavern in Fremont, California, where I grew up in the East Bay. And it was along, right across the street from one of the...
I'm going to write that down.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's gone, Dave, which is a sad... It's now a gift shop. But it was right across from one of the Franciscan missions, California missions.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that would always happen is that you would go on Christmas Eve, and I didn't go to church, but, you know, my friends would tell their parents they're going to Midnight Mass, but they would just go to the Mission Bell Tavern and not actually go to Midnight Mass. So that was always kind of fun.
Yeah, that's
see
pretty
all
good.
Friends.
They were crossing themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, I mean, you could see the church right out the window.
Yeah,
so,
they
worked great. Yeah. But it was also on the Hell's Angels circuit. So every sometimes, like on a Saturday afternoon, you know, they would sort of roll through. And that was always fun. I'll never forget. I mean, I go on as we all came about these bars. But one particular story was with a friend of mine that I went to high school with. And there was a guy, and his name was like, was a skinny, kind of greasy guy. And it was like Scrappy or something was his nickname. It was something along those lines. And he was talking to my friend Kristen. And as he's talking to her, this guy's probably 30. I mean, he looks like he's 80, but he's probably 30. And he's talking to Kristen, and his dentures come flying out of his mouth and land in her shirt pocket.
Wow. Wow.
I kid you not.
Oh, that's a lot. Take them out?
Yeah,
I don't want you taking them out.
Exactly.
But that's like Pele, man. This guy could have like scored so many soccer goals.
I know. Seriously.
You know, could have been a multimillionaire.
Wow. Absolutely. It was great. Wow. And as Dave said, it was like, you know, there's that brief moment of now what is protocol here? Protocol is now gone.
Can I get some chopsticks?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, holy Hannah. But I mean,
I think she got a napkin, if I remember right, and that, you know.
I had a very amusing experience a few years ago through my friend H. Joseph Ehrman, who owns a lovely bar in San Francisco, Elixir Tavern, which is great old bar.
Yeah, yeah.
And he, because I've written a lot about Gold Rush history, he got me inducted in this organization, E. Clampus Vetus, which is a it was founded during the Gold Rush as a parody of masonry. And so they've got like a ritual and you've got an initiation and they've got like E. Clampus Vetus posts and it's in nonsense Latin is the name and is just fake. And their motto is, I think, for to succor widows and orphans, but especially widows. But the people in it are a mixture of bikers, law enforcement, military, and historians.
That's a interesting salad.
It is weird.
Yeah.
And you go to an E. Clampus.
I don't want to toss that salad, man.
No. You go to one of their diggins, as it's called, you know, or their doings, rather, and they've got huge pots of food cooking because they've got military chefs, you know, cooks there.
Oh,
these guys know how to cook for 250 people. That's not a problem.
Unless they're boiling steaks. That's the other.
The
Apocalypse Now thing, you know.
They're on their best behavior for this.
All right,
But I mean, it's like, it sounds like I'm sure that the mission bell was on the Clampers circuit because those are the same people.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And you know, they put up plaques, historic plaques. Like they put up a plaque on the site of Hodling's whiskey warehouse. It was the only thing that was spared during the San Francisco fire in a whole neighborhood. You know, they put up all these plaques of disreputable stuff that happened in California history, and like where the last brothel was in like Marin County. You know, it's like the last one they know of. but it's all that kind of stuff, and it's all it's very weird and very amusing. But it's very Northern California, which always had that mix.
These are
the kind of historians that we are glad are around.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, hey, you guys, as much as I'd love to keep, I know you guys have places to be and listeners probably have things to do too, but we can continue the conversation and drink more Sazeracs, but I should probably close things out. Dave, can you tell people again where they can find, I'll shake your hand in a second.
Yeah.
Can you tell people where they can find you again?
I just see a hand. Yeah. You know, I'm at Tails.
I thought you were like, you know, give me the
Tails
block
of the cocktail. Hands just kind of reach towards me. And then they go around my shoulder and there's a camera. And I'm just used to it.
I'm going to go like this, Dave, and go, no foul. No foul.
All right. Ooh, it's been a long week. I'm the senior drinks columnist for the Daily Beast, so I write fairly long, involved columns on the history of drinks for that, two or three a month. And I'm also on Twitter at davidwandrich.com, and you can find my books wherever fine cocktail books are sold.
Don't forget your podcast, man.
Podcast. I'm on Twitter as at davidwandrich, not dot com. And my podcast, we have a podcast at the Daily Beast called Life Behind Bars with Noah Rothbaum and myself, my editor, where we try to be almost as jovial as this and talk about drinks topics. And I also have bar gear through Cocktail Kingdom, like replica 19th century bar gear.
Cool. Got the merch in this time. That was good.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, yeah.
I did.
Jeff?
I have to talk about Dave's bar gear for a little bit.
Do it.
The punch bowls, the 18th century recreations of punch bowls are pretty amazing. But as far as my own shit, beachbumberry.com, and you can just poke around there and find out what the stuff I've done or haven't done. And then latitude29nola.com for latitude29 in the very, very wet, hot French Quarter of New Orleans.
Yep.
But if you're within a 3 days drive of New Orleans and you don't go to Latitude 29, I think you're really
you're
kind of fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bless you, Dr. Wondrich, and I second that emotion.
Yeah. And if it matters, I'll go third on that one. It's a fine place, and it is a restaurant, right, Aneen?
There's food. There's food. There's appetizers, main courses, and desserts. It's like a full on experience, man. Eat the food so that I don't have to get divorced.
Thanks, you guys. I really appreciate you making time today.
Brian.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure, friends. A brief musical interlude. I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody, thanks for listening into the show this week, friends. As always, I do appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed that conversation there with Jeff and Dave. I know I did. Very, very insightful, very, very entertaining, and a lot of fun. Went a little bit long, and that's going to relate to what I'm going to talk about here in just a second with our parting shot. It's going to be a short one. But yeah, I looked down at the clock, and it was one of those things where I went, oh, damn, probably better cut this off. I could have just gone on forever. And it sort of harkens to something that Jeff was talking about when you find that great dive bar and time seems to stand still. Now, I know that these days, and I'm no philosopher, I'm no psychologist, but it's always easy to get caught up in what's next. And, you know, the idea of trying to live in the present, or the term mindfulness, having that, it's easier said than done. Sure, there's books out there and there's experts and lists of things to do to try and be mindful and be in the present. But sometimes it's a really simple thing. And this is exactly as Jeff said, that sometimes you're in that third space, the first two being work and home. The third space in this instance, we're talking about being in a great bar where time just seems to stop. It allows you to be present. In that conversation there, I was just present listening to those guys tell stories. And those are great moments in life. And really, oftentimes, friends, it doesn't take more than just going to your favorite establishment or maybe finding a new favorite establishment. So really, you know, a good drink and a good spot with good folks, no more than that, no less than that, is really all you need sometimes, right? To be present and to be in that moment. And those times that you do discover it, remember them, cherish them, and be in that space at that time. Because you know when that happens and time seems to be standing still, you know you're in the right place at the right time. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.